Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive.TV/Dave Martell. Live now at our new time slot every single Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern. So everybody make sure to go over to Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out our boy over there. He's doing real, authentic Vedic astrology. Go check it out, man. It's going to blow you away. Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. And tell him Big Dave sent you. Let him know I sent you over there. And if you like what The Bog does, you want to support us, you want to keep us going, keep the lights on, make sure to go over to Patreon.com/TheBog and go sign up. We got tiers from $5 all the way up to $50, all kinds of different stuff. You have merchandise, all kinds of stuff over there that you guys can go check out. We also, over there, have an RSS feed so you can get audio of all of our shows to listen to at work, at the gym, or in the car, on your drives and your commutes. We also have a store where you can get more merchandise. You could go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. I keep forgetting to put the URL up there on the screen, but I'll get it one of these days. I'll remember one of these days. But I apologize about last week, folks. I had to attend my grandfather's funeral, so unfortunately I could not... I wasn't in the right place to come on and do a show for you, but we're coming back this week here with a very cool episode tonight. And this is something that folks been asked a lot of. You know, we do a lot of theology, we do a lot of philosophy, we do a lot of history, and folks have a lot of practical questions. They say, you know, how do I start to practice the Germanic faith? How do I go about living a spiritual lifestyle? How do I go about injecting these things into my life in order to better myself and have a relationship with the divine and actually live it instead of just reading books all the time, which we love reading books. You know, books are wonderful, books are great, but there's more to this than just studying the Eddas, more to this than just studying philosophy and studying history and knowing all that stuff. There's an entire lifestyle that goes along with it. It's a beautiful, wonderful, fulfilling lifestyle that, you know, it's the whole reason why we do this. I love philosophy. Everybody loves philosophy. But I always say philosophy is downstream from theology, and theology is downstream from belief. Because without devotion and divine spark and true belief, philosophy is just a bunch of intellectual talky talk. It has to have the meat and potatoes behind it, the true foundation. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about more practical things. And then also we're going to talk about ways that folks can get into becoming better practitioners of their faith and so on and so forth. And without further ado, Tristan, Wolfman, Andre, what's going on tonight?
Oh, nothing much.
Well, I'm doing pretty good, Dave.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Andre, what's going on?
Yeah, nothing. Not really. It's pretty late here, so.
Excellent. So, let's get right
into it. It is a weary night in Norway.
Let's get right into it here. We have, each of us wrote down some pointers for you folks, for the listeners out there, from our opinions and our personal journeys. Pointers for you folks so you can get to put a foot into the faith, maybe if you're a newcomer, or maybe tonight we'll hit on some stuff that some experienced, some seasoned people out there that have been practicing for a long time. Maybe we'll hit something that'll help you guys out too. We're going to give, so, but everybody has 5 notes that they wrote down, suggestions, advice, pointers for folks out there to better have a more spiritual lifestyle, not just knowledge, but a lifestyle to go along with the knowledge. And I want to start out with Mr. Tristan. Mr. Tristan, tell us about one of the things on your list here. About what can you tell people about living a spiritual lifestyle?
Right. Well, one of my first instances for living a spiritual lifestyle is, I have it on my number 5 slot, introspection upon your beliefs and actions to ensure that they place the faith at the uppermost priority beyond politics or your desires or emotions or any kind of material agenda.
Did we just lose Tristan?
I think we did.
I think we did.
If you're going to follow a religion, then you have to...
Hey, Tristan, we're losing you. Your internet's cutting out, bud.
believe inherently in the religious dictates. It can't just be aided by the faith. It has to actually be because it is of the religious origins.
Mr. Tristan, you cut out real bad and we missed like half of what you said there. Could you sum it up real quick?
I'm sorry. I had myself on mute, unfortunately.
Oh.
I'll just start over. I had on my number 5 slot, I had introspection upon your beliefs and actions to ensure that they place the faith at the uppermost priority, beyond politics, your desires or emotions, or any material agenda. So if you're going to be a part of the religion and hold the faith, you need to ensure that your beliefs and the things you believe are part of the faith and obligated by it actually stem from the religion itself. It's not from some other ancillary perspective. It's not a political belief. It's not a social perspective you happen to hold. It's not what you think would be good for a society. It's actually something that the faith believes and mandates.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. That's something that a lot of folks struggle with. And it's not to get on anybody that is still struggling with that, but it's true, 100%. You know, your political worldview, everything that you see, your social beliefs, whatever, so on and so forth, should be downstream from your religion. Like, there's if it's anything else, then you're not being true to your faith. The God.
Well, I mean, it's extremely hard to deal with, especially within the faith, because of decades of interaction that's happened within the faith. People have gotten used to seeing certain things as being more or less, undetached from the faith itself, but it's not really. And especially when you come together with a bunch of people who hold naturally certain social or political beliefs, you might start to feel like, those are aspects of the faith or obligations thereof, but it's not really. And holding those positions is actually sometimes it's perfectly normal, like some things are in fact just mandated by the faith and it flows naturally, but some things are not actually mandated by the faith, and holding a belief in that is actually really harmful because it comes with other issues and side effects that people probably don't realize that they actually believe.
Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. It's just something people struggle with. And but what you mentioned about like political infighting within the faith, I think probably infighting might be as bad as it's ever been right now. But one thing that is exciting, and Mark points this out a lot, Mr. Mark Pereira, he says, what's the most exciting about the infighting now is we're actually infighting about religion instead of politics. So I thought that was a pretty cool take. But let's hear from Mr. Wolfman. I know he hasn't been feeling good today, but Mr. Wolfman, what do we got on the list? What is your suggestion to folks?
Well, just real quick to comment on the political thing. All their political arguments are lame anyway because we don't have kings. Or Jarls. Soft monarchy gang. Kind of aligned with what Tristan just said. I think this is number 4 on my list. I think it's real important to make time for meditation, contemplation, and really self-imposed solitude. We live in a very busy world, and a lot of people are on their phones and computers and social media a lot. I don't blame people for that. In today's world, that's kind of the predominant way to socialize, unfortunately. In a lot of communities, especially urban communities. So I don't begrudge them for that, but it's real important to step back from that, to make time for you, as women say, have some self-care time or whatever they call it, but in a spiritual sense, take a hike to a peaceful meadow that or go to a park that you like, go somewhere that, you feel in touch with nature, that you feel in touch with the divine, or at least that's not your normal trappings, your cubicle, your 4-bedroom wall, et cetera, et cetera. And really just think about what you believe about yourself, about the faith. Think about, your actions, like Tristan advised, how do your actions look? Like, how does it make you look? How does it make your ancestors look at you? How does it make your community look at you? And a lot of people, I think, today act without thinking or realizing the effects of their actions, not just on themselves, but on their family, their friends, especially in a day and age where so many people have issues with addiction, with depression, loneliness, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's real important to step back and examine why these things are, rather than just kind of the typical, oh, I have a problem, so I'm going to medicate it away, or I'm going to bury it in my emotional lockbox and stuff like that. I think it's important to just acknowledge where you are, who you are, what you believe, and how it affects your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful advice. What was that? There's a study done recently. Now, I'm from a state that got really, really hammered with the opiate epidemic. It was horrible here, especially like in my hometown, and you know, here in PA, we got absolutely smashed with it. Yeah, I can't tell you. I lost count of how many, you know, friends and family members and people I went to school with either died or went to prison. You know, people in my own family, like, did serious prison time. Some of my closest friends, I had to watch them get buried because of this opioid epidemic. It's absolutely horrendous. And they did a study with mice. I'm sure everybody here is probably familiar with it, but if you're not, you know, humor me here. What they did essentially was they had a community of mice, and they gave them water bottles full of, I believe it was morphine or something like that. It was water spiked with morphine, something of that nature. And they got these mice addicted to morphine. Well, the mice started to act as opiate addicts do. They got really addicted to the water with the morphine in it. And what was interesting about these mice is they had them in like isolated little cages. They kept them by themselves, gave them the morphine. It was like morphine next to water or something like that. But anyway, they got these mice hooked up on this morphine. And then after a while, they put the regular water next to the morphine water in a more community setting. And what happened was the mice, as soon as they got introduced into the community, they stopped drinking the morphine water. They actually cold turkey just stopped using the drugs because they had community. They had like fellow mice to hang out with. Zahn says the Rat Universe experiment. I'm not sure Rat Universe, but I am familiar with the Mouse Utopia experiment. We could talk about that sometime as well. I've actually read quite a bit on that with Dr. John Calhoun and everything like that. But essentially what I'm getting at, long story short here, is that we've been so isolated. Isolation, the removal from communal settings, the removal from the family settings, the removal from all of these different things has had so many effects, negative effects on us that we don't even know, we don't even realize. You know, back in the day before we had the isolating pressures of modern technology like smartphones and social media and so on and so forth, before we had all of that stuff back in, like, we'll say, you know, just in 50s America or something like that, 60s America, would we have witnessed the level of deaths and destruction from something like the opioid epidemic? I don't think so. Because I think that one of our biggest ailments in modern society is isolation, 100%. So I don't know if anybody feels differently, but that's just my take on it.
Well, I mean, morphine has been around for a long time. And I mean, in the Wild West, like, you know, morphine addicts were a known thing, but it was never really problematic. A lot of stuff wasn't really that problem. It wasn't problematic on a societal level until the rise of this isolating technology.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that take at all. And I think one of the main issues of the modern world is actually a reduction down to the nuclear family as the main component of society that basically has served to isolate everyone from a wider community.
Yeah,
that's one thing I like about a lot of Mexican cultures. They don't see their family as like mom, dad, siblings. They see their family as like literally like their whole clan. Which, you know, feeds stereotypes and whatnot, but it's a very true thing for their culture.
Well, and, you know, that's actually more accurate for an ancient Germanic perspective. The Germanic people had clans. They were called Aets, the Aetar. And, you know, that's just how people lived in long, you know, big houses with households with large people, you know, maybe even up to 30 people at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's quite a few different ethnicities that still operate like this. You know, you mentioned like... you know, certain Mesoamerican, I know people from India, and even like, you know, Italians, and you know, there's quite a few.
There's a very southern and western lineage or break in when you look at a map of Europe, that people on the south and towards the east of Europe all still retain a sort of communal living arrangement, where people towards the western and the northern component have transferred to a nuclear family arrangement generally.
I wonder if that corresponds with Protestantism.
You know, I think it more or less does. And I think there's actually a large argument to be made that it has to do with the radiant influence of the British Empire, because the nuclear family arrangement is a very North Seas, English, Netherlands sort of...
Yngwie-onic kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not so much Yngwie-onic because Sweden and Norway also didn't have that as well, and they still have a more community-oriented living arrangement, or what we would call patrilineal authoritative culture. It's an entire thing. But anyway, I think it has something to do with influence from the British Isles effectively radiating across Europe.
I would also attribute it to industrialization, because the British Empire was the driving force of the Industrial Revolution in Europe. If you read, I posted a thing on Primordial Path pretty recently. It was a quote from Charles Dickens, and it was from Charles Dickens. I believe the book's called Hard Times, and he's documenting and very poetically describing what he sees in, you know, industrial England, and he's saying you have these dirty-faced people. This place is filthy dirty. They do the same thing day in and day out all day long, and they're just all miserable, just worker drones. And that is something that they brought to the world very much. And not to say that Germany didn't have their own industrial revolution and these guys, not to say that we in America didn't have our own industrial revolution, but it was really brought to the table by the British Empire. And I would attribute it to industrialization. And what we're talking about here is I'm actually rereading a very interesting book right now. I'm going to do it for my book reviews. It's called Shrinking the Technosphere by Dmitry Orlov. And Dmitry, he talks about there's a difference between what he calls the technosphere and the biosphere. And the way that he describes it is people live in one of the two. And the biosphere is organic, it is elastic, it is qualitative, it adjusts to its own. It's a natural, organic place that you're supposed to be in. The technosphere, on the other hand, where the overwhelming majority of the world's inhabitants now live, is completely artificial. It's rigid. It's the technosphere is essentially living in your house with climate control, wall-to-wall carpet, screens, all of this stuff, all of the softening comforts of technology-driven modern life has perverted us on many different levels, genetically, socially, culturally, all of these things, and we're starting to reap the benefits of it, and I would very much agree with him there.
If I may, can I go into another one of my points, because it corresponds with exactly what you're talking about
absolutely,
right now.
Absolutely,
absolutely. So this was number one on my list, but it's living within nature. And so like you were just saying, how this technosphere versus biosphere stuff really is corrupting us, you know, spiritually, physically, anatomically, etc. There's all these studies now about how, you know, excess soy, like soy boy memes and stuff, you know, excess soy consumption, excess consumption of corn syrup, sugars, they have all these detrimental effects. And so something me and Tristan are both really interested in is, like, you know, sustainable organic agriculture, more or less. It sounds like a very hippie niche topic, but it's actually a really good thing to be into if you care about your health and, you know, your family's health and the health of your community. And so I think it's important. It's something, you know, I'm from a place where it's either urban cesspit or sand and rock. And so when I moved up north for school, I really kind of got in touch with being in nature. You know, I was from a very technosphere environment for most of my life. And so I got to really see how life really works when there's no climate control, when there's no synthetic components to the stuff you're doing. And people are just healthier. Their relationships are healthier. Their spirituality is healthier. Even if they're not religious, they tend to just be more spiritual and comfortable people. The hospitality difference in sociability is kind of a manifestation of that. People, you know, there's the stereotype that rural folks are typically more welcoming, more generous. And I think that that's because they typically reside in the biosphere versus the technosphere. The technosphere is, you know, the creation. It's what man wrought rather than what man is. And to be healthy, we need to be what man is. You know, we need to be ourselves and use our tools rather than letting our tools use us.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people will... you know, the whole thing is that urbanite people that are within the technosphere more than people are not, they have more of the trait of agreeableness, more so. In fact, it's if you have ever lived in an urban community, like an urbanite setting, everybody, agreeableness is 100% their biggest trait. And rural people have less agreeableness. They're a little bit more likely to be defiant and stuff like that. And a lot of people equate this with, they think that if you're agreeable, that you're going to be a nicer person. This is completely false. To be agreeable does not necessarily mean to be welcoming or nicer or anything like that. It means that you are going to be less likely to be tolerant of somebody that is against, I guess, the status quo.
When it comes to urban agreeableness, I think you have to make a distinction between being friendly and what is the urban setting for agreeableness. It's basically just a lack of masculinity. They're effectively cowards. They're conflict avoidant.
Yeah, well, that's essentially they serve the hive. You know what I mean? They have hive mentality. Whereas people that are rural, they have less of the agreeable trait, but they are more likely to tolerate you. You know what I mean? They're more likely to having less of the agreeableness trait. It gives them the ability to be more hospitable, have more of that, you know, country hospitality kind of stuff. So that's something I just wanted to throw out there. And a lot of people equate those things and conflate those things, but they're not exactly the same thing. So let's hear from Andre.
Yeah, I guess it's a point that connects into what both Ian and Tristan has said, you know, and it's related to the values and the lessons and the laws that one can find inside the religion. You can find it inside the faith. That you have to not just learn, you shouldn't just memorize it, but you should try and live by it. You should try and understand them on a fundamental level. And yes, of course, there are religious laws such as don't commit to things like that could be considered sacrilege. However, there are things that are less obvious that a lot of people fail to understand because their meaning has been corrupted or it has been lost or it has become kind of convoluted in the modern setting. Such words as piety, for instance. To practice piety as a value, it's a bit of a tricky one because a lot of people conflate the idea of piety with, I guess, an Abrahamic sense of complete subservience. You have to grovel to the floor and pray to the cross. That's it. That's piety. While other things such as honor and loyalty are words that have even become dirty words in their own right in a modern setting. And I think in order to live a truly spiritual life inside this faith in particular, things like piety, honor, loyalty are key components that you have to not just only understand, but you have to learn them and you have to live by them. It does not matter how many rituals or how many prayers or offering or bloats that you do if you are incapable of living without loyalty and honor to your friends, to your family, to your kin, whatever it should be. At that point, it's just lip service if you're just doing the traditional religious things. You have to learn the values and the virtues that our ancestors cultivated for thousands of years. And they were not necessarily always written down because there's a lot of subtlety here. But you still have to be able to look at it and act on it. You have to live by their example. Not copy them exactly, because the world isn't the same as it was 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. But you still have to consider these things, because these values that they have passed down to us are timeless.
Beautiful. Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I would agree with all of that. Real quick, we got a quick dono from, who we got here? Project Algis. Donated one lemon. Thank you, Project Algis. Much love to you. Many blessings. So, moving along, I'm going to read one of mine here. This is one that gets kind of overlooked. This is one that, actually, this is kind of like a few, but I'm going to try to throw them all in together. So, when I teach people, and I've had the pleasure of kind of taking over the years, becoming more of a teacher. And people, you know, reach out to me and say, "Dave, how can I change myself into a spiritual person? How can I pursue this this faith? How can I walk our ancestral path?" So on and so forth. I tell them right away. I ask, "What's your diet like? What's your sleep schedule like? Are you somebody that exercises? Are you somebody that takes care of yourself? You cannot have a strong spirit and a strong mind without a strong body. That's where it starts. That's where it all starts. You know, having a good routine, sleeping well, eating well, making sure you're eating things that have good und, making sure you're eating things that are natural, making sure you're eating things that are as close to their original form as possible. Keep this in mind. A steak is always better than a cheeseburger. We'll say, you know, a salad with fresh greens. We're talking maybe some endive and spinach and kale and so on and so forth. That's going to be better than, you know, some gobbledygook drink that you buy from the store. You know, forming a relationship with your food is very important. You know, growing your own food, having a garden. Man, I've been preaching about gardens for years and years now on my podcast, and I can't tell you how many people send me pictures of their tomato gardens now. They grow nicer tomatoes than me. That's tough because Big Dave grows beautiful tomatoes. So this is the kind of stuff that is imperative to a spiritual lifestyle, and it's not sexy. It's not over the top. It's not esoteric and mysterious. It's very mundane. And it's very practical, but it is 100% necessary, and it gets overlooked a lot. And it's just, that's where you have to start. It's absolutely where you have to start. You know, making sure that you are living correctly, having plants in your house, making sure there's life flowing within your apartment or house or wherever you're living. All of these kinds of things, having fresh herbs to cut and put into your food that you're cooking, mastery of all things that you do. You know, everything that you do, you want to become the best that you can at it all day long. Your life, everything you do is devotional. Everything. Everything is a ritual. Keep this in mind. Everything that is in the material plane, that is in the earthly realm, is a reflection replicated in reflection or in polarity in a higher realm. You know, there's a lot of like Gnostics that say that and stuff like that. So if we think that that's true, then we have to understand that everything that we do is a spiritual act, that everything we do is a ritual, and we want to do it positively and good. And that means good diet. That means not watching porn. That means not listening to garbage music, because it's not just food that has good and bad und. It is also music. It is anything that you put into your body, anything that you put into your mind, anything that you put into yourself, anything that you intake. We're talking entertainment. We're talking food. We're talking drink. We're talking everything. And this is the one that I struggle with the most. You know what I mean? I'm full admittance here. 100% honesty. I love food. You know, when I got into spirituality, I got rid of the drugs. I got rid of the drinking and the partying. I got rid of messing with the girls. I got married. I got rid of all that stuff. I that was a piece of cake. What's hard for me, what I struggle with, and we all struggle with things, is, you know, because Big Dave loves to have a good time. So pizza, hoagies, pasta, you know, beer, birch beer, relaxing, loafing, hanging with my boys, grilling, eating sausages. Like that's what I struggle with. And this past month, I've made it a point that I am working out now. Every other day, I'm working out. I'm pumping the iron. I'm going into the temple of iron, dedicating. And every time I go in, I say a prayer to the Thunderer, to Lord Thor, and I dedicate my workout to him. And I tell you what, man, I'm operating at a level that I haven't in a long, long time. So everybody out there, man, get into the temple of pump. Get your pump on. Lift some weights. Go work out. Get your diet right. Get all that stuff. That is the beginning of a true, good, fulfilling spiritual lifestyle.
And never be afraid to start. You know, a lot of people, especially if they're out of shape or hesitant to, you know, go to the gym where people can see them and stuff. No built Chad dude is ever going to make fun of the guy that's like trying his best, unless they're a total douche. And in that case, ignore their opinion anyway. But people got a lot of respect for people that put in effort. And like Dave was talking about, you know, gardening and all that stuff being important. There's nothing wrong with you and your buddies having a gardening club. I know a lot of people hear that kind of thing and laugh, but there's nothing wrong with it. And it's all good things. in this day and age, there's a lot of tendency in community to kind of ridicule people that go against, you know, the grain and kind of take better choices. Like, Dave, you were saying you gave up partying and drinking and all that kind of stuff. I had an experience a few years ago when I more or less renounced a lot of that stuff. And I had, you know, quote unquote, friends dropping left and right because I was no fun anymore. I was boring. But your lifestyle, if you are really, you know, true to the faith and you really want to live your beliefs, these people are not your friends. And if they drop you over you wanting to be better and live better, then they don't have what's best for you in their mind. So you're better off dumping them.
Yeah, exactly. Over the COVID thing, man, I put on a lot of weight. I'm not so much anymore. I'm getting out of it, but there was a time I was like the fattest I've been in my life and I was feeling really rotten about it. So I started working out and stuff like that. And you know who was the first people to reach out and encourage me? My friends and buddies that are big Jack Chads, my buddies that are big gym rats, the guys that are, you know, in the gym that are all, you know, all ripped and stuff. They're the first guys that say, you know, encouraging me, texting me, showing me love, you know, sending me blessings, coming over to help me out, teach me things. They were the first ones. So don't ever feel intimidated. Don't ever feel intimidated at all. And, you know, what is that? I know it's cliche, but that Chinese proverb, whatever they say about planting trees. Well, start planting your trees and get into the Temple of Pump right now and start eating good right now.
I would also want to add another thing here is that, you can see this, like you said, Dave. Like you have a you said that you had a problem with like food and so forth. You like having a good time, like you like eating good food, and like in a way that there should be a certain degree of acceptance to certain things like this, because it's a process. It's not just a switch that you can turn on and off. You can't make such radical life changes that you decide I'm going to go from 0 to 100 immediately. You cannot just start by, for instance, having a tremendous organic garden and switching completely overnight. And that is what intimidates a lot of people, I feel. But small steps can go a long way. And it's a process that you can develop over time. If you like pizza, for instance, it's 10 times better to just make it yourself than it is to buy a frozen pizza. And that is perfectly fine, too. It's a process to start developing the right habits. And developing habits, as I said, it goes over time. Because it's really, really, really hard for a lot of people to just switch over to what... Actually, some people seem to encourage to have almost a completely ascetic lifestyle. And if you're not able to do it, you're just weak-willed. Why don't you do it properly?
You mean the real Aryan men watch the paint dry for fun kind of people?
Yeah, quite literally.
Yeah. And, you know, a couple weeks back, me and Dave had a blowout about which holiday is the best. I took Halloween, Dave took Christmas. And, you know, we actually had a discussion about how the Germanic culture viewed partying, having fun, drinking, eating, feasting, that sort of thing. And I would have to note that even though there's a sort of impetus in modern times to go for a sort of ascetic lifestyle, this was actually very contrary to how the upper classes of the Germanic people always lived and behaved amongst themselves. And I would just have to say that, you know, people, if you're not being hurt and it's not detracting from your own life and health and spiritual ability, you shouldn't feel compelled to engage in an ascetic lifestyle. Such a thing isn't really found within the Germanic people. But of course, if it is harming you and, you know, you're fucked up on drugs all the time and you're an alcoholic, well, then, yeah, maybe you need some help. You need to stop.
Moderation is always key. You know, like the people that are like, oh, you know, stop playing video games, stop having hobbies, stop, you know, eating pizza, stop drinking alcohol. There's such a thing as, you know, having self-control. Like, you can play, you know, your Vidya for an hour a day or whatever, and it's not a big deal. But if you're spending like 16 hours a day on it, then yeah, that's probably a problem.
And also a lot of people, this is a life-affirming faith. Mark Breer writes in the Otis book that the gods, when we most of the time we're reading about the gods, they're celebrating. I mean, the gods want us to be happy. They want us to enjoy life. We don't acknowledge samsara and escaping the cycle and like all that Eastern stuff. For us, we're here in the cycle forever and ever. So why not enjoy it? You know, my problem was I was feasting too much. I like pizza too much, man. If we get a pizza, like my kindred comes over, we get pizza. It's like I could, if we're drinking beer and hanging out, I'll eat 6-7 pieces of pizza throughout the night, and I won't even realize it because I'm a big guy. I like to eat. Yeah, it's nothing for me. So I had to start thinking like, okay, I need to count how many pieces of pizza I'm eating. I need to not get pizza every single weekend. You know, I still get my feast on,
yeah, but
on holidays. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry, Tristan. I thought you were saying something. But anyway, that's pretty much what I wanted to get at there. It's not, you don't have to be an ascetic. You don't have to become some monk that lives in a temple and eats nothing but rice and punches pillars and smashes your head against the sidewalk all day so you can achieve nirvana or something like that. Enjoy life. Life is beautiful. Life is a joyous gift.
Well, but I think too, like, to add to that, you know, life is to be savored, but gluttony is a bad thing. Experience life, enjoy life, but don't make enjoyment and, you know, consumption your primary impetus for being, which is what a lot of people unfortunately do.
What does it say in the Havamal about everybody laughing at the fat guy because he's a big fat idiot? You know what I mean? That's
he's turned into a fool.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really good as a generalized advice book for people who are just starting out because it covers the basics, but it also covers the higher things. So, but it just covers things like the fact that you shouldn't be greedy. You should be happy if you have a home. You should be satisfied with the fact that, you, for instance, you have one child. That is something to be satisfied about. You shouldn't drink too much. Don't be a glutton. Don't speak just to speak. Think before you say something.
Yeah, exactly. What does it say? It says, one's own home is better. A man is master in his home. Even having a couple of goats and a corded roof is better than begging or something of like that. I'm bad at reciting things. But if you're just getting started with this, man, don't be ashamed that you live in an apartment and you got one potted tomato plant. There's nothing wrong with that. Man, a few years ago, actually more than a few years ago now, but man, when I was a bachelor, I had a little porch in my apartment and I had two potted tomato plants. That's it. And then I grew that. And I was so proud of that. And I had some basil in my windowsill. And I was so proud of that. That's, you know, I might not have a big 50 by 100 garden growing tons of stuff like our boy Folkish Farmer did, but I was proud of my two lousy, weak, measly tomato plants that the neighbor's cat peed on and chewed up the leaves. But it was still mine, and I was very proud of that. And there's, you know, Ian pointed out, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that there's almost, and this is touching on another point ahead, there's almost, like you said earlier, there's like a ritual aspect to it. You know, Frey, for example, is regarded oftentimes as the lord of agriculture and, you know, the bountiful harvest. And, you know, my mom had a real green thumb. I kind of grew up around, like, gardener-type people. You know, I used to like going to the home improvement store to get, like, the praying mantis eggs to serve as organic pest control-type stuff. And there was always something very fulfilling about growing something yourself that you then consumed or decorated your home with. Like, for us, based on climate and, you know, just the kind of dirt we had, it was, you know, a couple lemon trees, a small vegetable patch, and roses. And so, and other flowers. So, you know, the home, like having the home overflowing with life, overflowing with color, that's all stuff that you might not think it's that important, but it has a profound effect on your life.
Exactly. Beautiful flowers that smell nice. There's nothing gay about having that stuff.
Nope, not at all.
Not at all.
People that say flowers are gay are probably extremely insecure in their own masculinity, honestly.
Yeah, they probably have just like a plain white square room, and they sit on the floor in front of their 50-inch TV where they play PlayStation.
Or, you know, their idea of masculinity is the kind of whiskey they drink and how expensive the steak they order is.
Yeah. No, I'm the opposite. I like to brag about how much money I saved. So
humility is a virtue. Like,
yeah, absolutely. So moving on, Mr. Tristan, what do you have next on your list there?
Well, you know, I had a really interesting one, and I'm going to have to warn you guys ahead of time. I've tried explaining this to people before, and it's a very personal thing that it doesn't really transfer well, and I can't really describe it extremely great. So work with me a little bit as I try to explain myself here. But it's communing with your Hugr and Hamingja, and thus the will of your ancestors. When we read the sagas and other spiritual works of our ancestors, we have this note that they seem to believe that through some sort of introspection that they can come to the correct decision about what they should do in the future or how they should interpret things that are done to them. And it's very personal. It has to do with their clan, their family. It might be very different from other clans or other families and has to do with their station of birth, their own spiritual inheritance, so to speak. These are aspects of the soul, which reside within the body, and through some sort of introspective communion with them, we can learn their will in order to follow what is correct in our spiritual inheritance. This takes time and effort because, of course, most modern people they don't even know what the subject is. They've never even heard of these words before. Mm-hmm. And so you could probably go through it with meditation of some sort. You need to ask yourself personally. And I almost describe it as something like instinctive or intuitive. It's not like you're going to be told, hey, buddy, this is what you should do, right? But there's something in the back of your mind that tells you this is right. This is the correct action. This is the correct feeling. And through familiarity with this, you'll strengthen the bonds and be able to more easily commune with this aspect of the soul.
Beautiful. I think that made sense.
It did make sense. I'd want to. I guess you could call it like a sort of gut feeling. In a way, you're thinking to yourself like what would be the right action, and you kind of get this instinctual gut feeling that I should probably do this. Or if you're so inclined to ask or see if you can commune, I guess, with your ancestors and think what would be more in line with what my grandfather would have said if he was a respectable man, what would he have done? And in a way that is in and of itself, it's a really powerful feeling that a lot of people just dismiss because you might just think it's just a passing or fleeting thought or whatever like that. But it's probably a lot deeper than that.
Well, instincts are valuable. I mean, we all exist because our ancestors had the proper instinct to survive. I mean, being alive today is actually kind of a lottery when you consider the probability, the scope of human history and natural history and whatnot. So trust your instincts. I mean, you're alive because of your ancestors having them, and they've passed them on to you. Like with all things that our ancestors pass on to us, you should treasure and value them.
Absolutely, 100%. So, we're coming up on time here. So, let's move over to the Wolf Band. What else do you have there, sir?
Well, let's see. For one, respecting natural law, because it's the law of the gods, that is extremely paramount for anyone of the faith, I think. And I'm not saying this means you need to be some environmental activist sort of thing, but, for example, especially in modern, less so now, but modern communities, especially with hunters and ranchers and stuff, this is more of a me and Tristan thing than for you guys, but there's a lot of attitudes about exterminationism towards certain species or, be they plant or animal. And that kind of thing always rubs me the wrong way, even if I understand, say, the economic incentive or whatever it is. But I just don't believe that any human has the authority or, true ability, honestly, because all things are within the realm of the gods, but to really change nature to suit their own desires. That to me is the epitome of sin and the epitome of ergy kind of stuff. It's the inability to deal with what is, so an attempt to manipulate or subvert to make good for yourself. Yeah. And so with natural law, and I don't mean to be brazenly offensive or whatever, but I would say, for example, the modern defiling of bodies, prostitutes, porn stars, transgender people that literally have disgusting acts committed on their personhood is the epitome of breaking natural law. I mean, in a Lokean sense, Loki's crimes are particularly heinous because he is subverting natural law. He's subverting the order of the gods. And subverting order and natural order, which is the primordial order, is doing the direct work of chaos and entropy. So it's a big no-no. Don't do it.
Yeah. I believe Hindus would describe that as adharmic, saying that they're going against natural law and stuff like that. And when we're talking about natural law, we're not talking about what animals do. It's not necessarily that, but it is the order of reality, that which is how could I describe it? Tristan, how would you describe natural law in one sentence?
I would describe natural law as being that which is already ordained within the fabric of reality.
Yeah. Tristan is our in-house Aristotelian guy. And I actually was going to point out, Mr. Tristan, your last piece of advice that you had was very Aristotelian, being able to discern good and bad just with your gut instinct. That sounds very close to his virtue ethic.
Well, of course, it's a very Indo-European thing that within us we are good because we are noble and right. And so within our nature is the ability to discern what is good and noble and right. It's almost the opposite of the Christian perspective, which has us born within sin and always tempted towards wrongness and that sort of thing.
I was going to say, you got John Calvin rolling in his grave.
Right. He's pissed right now. Actually, he's probably already figured out that he was wrong, and he's in Helheim right now. But
that's actually one of the things I find most amusing about the sort of, well, some of your ancestors were Christians, right? Well, I assume at some point they're going to have a really shock when they go up to the Helting and figure out what the gods are now judging them. Yeah. They're going to be changing their minds real quick.
Olaf Tryggvason shitting his pants upon arrival.
Yeah. But we got a couple of donos. Behold a chair, one lemon. Chris, one lemon. Noyota, one lemon. Thank you very much to each and every one of you. Many blessings. So let's go over to Mr. Andre. What else did you have on your list there?
Well, to combine this, I guess, with the natural law, as well as taking something that was very personal for me, just to give a little bit of context, is when I was a child, I was always a very curious child. I was always running around, picking up animals, trapping insects to look at them, and so forth. And as a very young child, I was always called a scientist. Later, when I became more of a teenager and, you know, an adult even, I still kept that. And I was wondering, you know, why I had this. Because people tended to call me like a naturalist because of that. And when I found the faith, when I started looking into it, I kind of rationalized it and understood it better. Because I was opening myself to the majesty, beauty, and the mystery that you see all around. If you look at just a tree, most people just see a tree. Maybe someone sees a chair or something like that, but that's a very human process to think like that. But if you truly look at a tree, you not only see millions and millions of years of evolutionary history, you are seeing a fragment of the creations of the gods themselves. What we see around us in the natural world, animal, plant, bacteria, it doesn't matter. In and out of itself, every little life, everything that's alive, every creation, rock and so forth, is a manifestation and a creation of the gods as much as humans are. We have a special place as well, but when we look around us and open ourselves to this mystery and try to understand it with our own mind, in and out of itself, I find that, for me, at least personally, that was a really helpful way for me to learn a degree of humility and spirituality.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's really a beautiful thing, especially when you're doing your und work and you're doing your breathing and your meditation. There's once in a while you kind of just tap into the essence of nature, and you realize that it is such this beautiful web of many, many complex living things. It's incredible. It's really incredible.
Well, as if you look at it, like if someone at home, for instance, if you have a pet, a dog or a cat or a fish or a plant, just looking at it and you just think, okay, that's a dog. But if you truly think about it, there are literally billions of moving parts that make up this animal, and everything has to work in absolute order. There is an absolute order to those billions of parts that has to work exactly in order to make this creature that's, you know, probably sleeping on your couch or something, just to function, to just make it alive. And it's not only alive, it's sentient. It's acting on instinct, but also knowledge, and it's able to show affection and so forth. And if that is not evidence for the majesty and the complexity of the world that the gods themselves have, you know, given to humanity, I don't know what is.
Well, interesting to add to that is in the ancestral Slavic religion, they're cognate for Odin, more or less, Svarog. He's regarded as the god of like smithing an artifice, because like the idea is that all things that are, you know, like you were just talking about with dogs and, you know, how we're all composed of, you know, tons of different parts that all need to work together. The idea for them is that, you know, that the spirit of life, you know, the wind that Odin breathed into man's lungs to give him that essence, that it's more or less that Odin is like this divine, or not Odin, you know, Svarog, because it's Slavs, but that's the divine artificer that constructed everything like a skilled craftsman and then breathed life into it. And I think that's just a really interesting concept.
It's beautiful. So moving on, I want to, before we run out of time here, I want to touch on this one here that I have on my list that I wanted to hit. Community, 100% community. You know, we did talk about some of it early on about the mouse experiment and how technology puts us into these isolating things. Let me tell you something. I know there's people out there that say that they're a solitary practitioner and stuff like that. And everybody likes to use the word esoteric and talk about esotericism and things that are esoteric and mysterious because that's sexy and it's edgy and stuff like that. But this is at first and foremost an exoteric faith, meaning the practices are done without, are done with others, are done in a community. It's not something you do by yourself. You cannot. You know, I mean, I don't mean to offend anybody here that hasn't joined the community yet or joined a community yet, but that should be a goal, 100%. You cannot fully practice this faith 100% until you are in a community of sorts, whether it's with your family or if you have a few people or so on and so forth. I wouldn't say that you can't practice it at all 100% or anything like that, but you're not reaching your full capacity. You know what I mean, you're not truly experiencing it on its highest level unless you're doing it with your kin and your kindred or your clan or your fellowship or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, you know, I think I would actually take exactly what you were saying you're going to not try to do here, Dave, and just say outright that if you're not part of a community or a group that is also performing the rituals in a communal sense, you're basically unable to practice the religion as it's supposed to be done by our ancestors. We are very different than a Christian missionary universal religion. You're not saved by faith. It has to do with ritual mostly.
Well, I mean, I would not to argue with you or nothing, but I don't even know if the idea of like being saved even comes into it for us.
Well, it's not. I mean, that was a ancillary to the issue, but you understand what I was getting. The difference.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah.
I would agree with that completely. And it's just I hear people talk about what is esoteric a lot. I see a lot of stuff about it, and there's nothing wrong with esotericism. Esotericism is very cool and interesting and fascinating and important too. You know, when we talk about the Galdur, we talk about doing our chants and our prayers and all of this stuff. That's esotericism. That's proper Germanic esotericism. You know, doing your meditations. That's esotericism. You know, not kind of like, you know, hermetic inspired occultism or Helena Blavatsky and all that stuff. That stuff has nothing to do with us. The way we practice the esoterics is an extension of the exoteric. Exoteric comes first. Bloat, which is Odin says in the Havamal. Odin says in the Havamal, you know, do you know how to bloat? Do you know how to sing? Which is what he's saying is, do you know how to pray to the gods? Do you know how to bloat? Essentially telling you, you have to know how to do these things. You need to do these things. And these are exoteric things. He doesn't say anything about what's esoteric.
Yeah, in the Icelandingabok, the Book of Iceland, there's a passage in which a man who was famous for, you know, deriding the gods and saying that he would never do sacrifice to them is murdered by his own slaves. And his brother-in-law says, thus I will always see it done to those who would do no sacrifice. I am always very, very suspicious of people who are always talking about esoterics, because there's a lot of what we could generously call occultic influence and infiltration into the faith. If all you're interested in is magic and rune shit and stuff like that, I mean, you're not really a member of the religion. You don't have belief in the gods. You don't have anything of that.
Well, yeah, that's like
part of the faith. I mean, that's part of the faith, but that's not quote unquote the faith, right?
Well, taking that up as like the prime focus is almost like the Crowley Blavatsky kind of element, where it's like you're focusing more on the occult, the esoteric, than like
That's what I mean. That's what I mean about occultist infiltration into the faith, is that these people are often highly syncretic. They've come from hermetic influences or Crowley or Thelema and that sort of thing, and or even Satanism, and that's how they primarily understand a religious structure, and they've basically just become interested in paganism because, you know, they understand inherently that being a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim revolves around some sort of actual faith, and they've rationalized themselves into thinking that a pagan religion is not like that.
It's almost like D&D, and they view it as almost like a school of magic or something. Like, oh, I know the dark arts of Satanism. Now I'm going to go learn the natural magic of paganism. And I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a loose way to talk about it. But whenever I see someone, you know, of the faith that's really obsessed with like runes and like not ritual in the sense of like bloat, but ritual in the sense of like that sort of thing, you know, binding runes and stuff, I always have to wonder, like, what exactly is your motivation for study? Because it seems to be more based on like the magicianship or something like that, you know, seether rather than actual, I don't know, religiosity. That's just my impression, though.
Yeah, when people a question I get a lot is, can you recommend a good book on the runes? And I don't think that one has been written yet. And I don't think that they say, well, what runes do you? I don't even do any sort of rune magic, because I'll be honest with you, rune magic isn't exactly a thing. Yeah, I mean, we have no real examples of people practicing rune magic outside of divination, like casting the runes. And that was something that was done by a very small percentage of people. That wasn't...
Well, I should clarify that we do know rune magic was a thing that was done. It's found in the sagas, but we don't understand how they did it beyond that they wrote some runes and it was a magical thing that did something. Like, it doesn't give us a formula or explain exactly what was done.
Yeah, I was referencing essentially rune magic as people understand it today. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also like to point out someone like, I guess someone like Egil Skallagrimsson, which was, you know, kind of like a rune master of his time there. He explicitly warns against using runes if you don't know what you're doing, and only a select few chosen people know what they're doing. If you're using runes wrong, you're going to end up either cursing yourself or cursing someone else, because you're not supposed to be using it.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring up that exact example there, Andre, that there was a passage of the saga where Egil is called in because there's this, you know, like a woman who was sick, and they wrote runes of healing to try to help her get better, and they had basically just borked it up, and it was actually making her worse, and he had to erase them and redraw the runes in a correct format in order to help her get better. So we do know that rune magic did work like that in a sigil sort of fashion, but, you know, like, we don't know exactly what's going on, and that should make you very, very nervous, that story itself, that it's very easy even for our own ancestors who lived and breathed that religion to just mess it up.
Yeah, so... But what the way that people understand runes nowadays, that everybody is their own priest, everybody's a magician, you know, everybody makes stave runes, and there's nothing wrong with understanding and learning and memorizing. I can read in the runes almost fluently, you know what I mean, in English anyways. You know what I mean, I love the runes. I have the runic Edda. I love runes. You know what I mean, everybody does. But the overwhelming majority of examples of the runes that we have in digs and archaeology and stuff like that is like people writing Sven was here, or this, or writing their names on tools. It was first and foremost an alphabet. It was a very practical thing. It wasn't always about magic and mysterious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways of doing the runes. There does seem to be some sort of magical spelling in which they embody some sort of concept. But as you say, it was also just used as straight up an alphabet in the exact same format that our alphabet is used. They're phonetic characters that can spell out words.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to get at is not necessarily that rune magic didn't exist at all, but that the way that people think that runes, how important runes, there's far too much emphasis on rune magic and stuff now. You know, yep. There's thousands of books written on runes from all these different people, and everybody's interested in casting rune magic and stuff like that. But our ancestors would have thought that was nuts. They're like, why is it that nobody's worried about bloat? How come people aren't worried about you know, the gods? Why aren't people doing Galdr? Why aren't people doing their prayers? You know what I mean? Well,
full admittance, I mean, I do have rune tattoos, but people always ask me what they mean, like there's supposed to be some great hidden esoteric sorceress meaning, and I never tell anyone because I kind of like to let them feed that. But in reality, it's more or less just a basic message of like, this is my, like, my name is this, I care about this. It's very simple, like almost the alphabetical kind of way. And so it always amuses me that people think that like it's like some kind of sorcery inscribed upon my flesh.
No, it's a practical alphabet thing, and it's, you know, it does have they are special characters. It is special.
Like, there's an energy to each character, like you're talking about, but that's a far cry from like, okay, inscribing this rune means like this magical thing happens. That's not how it works, as we've been talking about.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I run into people all the time that, you know, they have tattoos of runes on their face, and they carve runes into everything, and they stay from, and it's like, what Galdrs do you know? And they don't know any. When was the last time you've been to Bloat? They haven't been at all. What clan are you a member of? Nothing.
You know, the Sand Dune clan. Me and Tristan are the Red Rock clan, aren't we, Tristan?
Yeah. And, you know, to go back to what you were saying, Dave, is that if anyone anywhere tells you they know exactly how rune magic works, there's some rune master, those people are lying charlatan frauds. No one knows how rune magic functions.
Probably trying to make a dollar off of you or get them to sign up for your newsletter, their newsletter or something like that, join their society.
Yeah. So now, speaking of esoterics, I have one more that I wanted to throw out there. This is something that I find very important with spiritual experimentation. I very much support the use of psychedelics in the quest of spirituality, more specifically psilocybin mushrooms.
you could go ahead for you first, Tristan.
Right. I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea. In fact, we've, you know, discussed the topic with Kerwin quite frequently. And although I myself do not partake in any sort of drugs or anything of that sort, it's not something I've ever actually done. I've given the impression that other people do have tremendous benefits from it. And even I am myself rather interested and curious about the matter.
If I may interject.
Absolutely.
So the thing... There is a case to be made, and Kerwin loves to make the case, for the use of such things. But from my personal experience, you know, I was up in Oregon in the forests of Western Oregon, a very kind of spiritual place if you're inclined to trees and hills like I am. And for the first and only time, I had the magic mushroom. And quite literally, I don't remember what happened. From what my friends told me, I more or less leaned out the window of my friend's car as though I was like a cavalier, like hacking and slashing at phantom people. And then we got to a park where they went to like go smoke a blunt or something. And I quite literally just wandered off into the woods for like a day. And they ended up finding me because they were looking for me like hours later, just wandering on the side of the road, claiming that I had, and you know, this is take it with a grain of salt, claiming that I had met, you know, an old man that called himself Odin. This is like YouTube commentary. Everyone claims that. But I don't remember that at all. It was probably just me rambling. And frankly, I'd probably been listening to a Monomarth on the drive out there. So that probably had something to do with it. But the idea was that what I
did a bunch of ravens follow you all day?
Until the ravens followed me, chanting my name, telling me to look north.
it was actually carrion birds.
No. Well, ravens technically are. But anyway, the thing that I do remember, and I wouldn't say that I met Odin, never, but I remember being in the woods and having twilight on me. I don't know if this was like drug-induced hallucination or dreamtime memory or something, but I remember just like almost like Gandalf Fangorn Forest in Lord of the Rings. I vaguely recall in like a distorted sense of reality kind of coming into a glade and seeing a cloaked figure and dropping to my knee as though, like, you know, being blinded by like the sun at full intensity or something. And it was kind of like a whiteout from that point. And so the only reason that I kind of gave my friends any credence to the fact that I was rambling about Odin is because of that. Now, what I actually think happened in a very practical sense is that maybe, you know, while being on that substance, not that I actually had any physical or literal experience, but it's more like we were talking about a bit ago, that your mind can kind of almost, for ease of use, just slip into that space where it's more easily contacted by the divine. And, you know, for a lot of people that that smoke marijuana or that consume cannabis in, you know, some form, there's a lot of the medical reason behind that, but also too, there is, and you know, I'd say from personal experience, not that I'm like some dude weed stoner guy, but there's a difference between looking, like thinking about something theistically and thinking about it, you know, being sober versus being, you know, under the influence or slightly under the influence. Like, this isn't saying that, you know, your average like skate, like longboarding, poncho wearing idiot is like some like profound master of theism. But there's a way that when you're just thinking about, you know, bloat, for example, it has a different element when you kind of have an altered state of mind, because it almost seems like the energy is more real. Like the reason that you're doing the thing that's not physical is more potent. And, you know, you could dismiss that as like, of course, you're on the influence of something. But as Kerwin has made the case, like these substances, when used properly and responsibly, not only are they, you know, trad gang, but they also do have a lot of textual backing for being important for the purpose of ritual. And I don't think that's a mistake.
Yeah, it is 100% historically attested that our ancestors used mind-altering substances. We've had digs with people that have cannabis seeds, like priestesses that had cannabis seeds. We have found psilocybin mushrooms. Liberty caps grow naturally all throughout the lands of where the Germanic people inhabited. It's tied to so many things. It is, and on top of that, on top of using them for, you know, I'd never ever tell people it's part, like, these aren't party favors. This isn't something that you, and obviously, you know, you could use these things in a recreational sense and have fun, because we are people that like to have fun. I like to get out and get a little wild sometimes, but these are first and foremost a spiritual tool. These aren't things to be abused.
To comment on that, I mentioned earlier that I had a lot of friends fall away from me after I kind of abandoned that sort of lifestyle. Something that even years before that always caused a lot of tension was, you know, when we were all doing the, you know, smoking weed thing, is that they would like to, you know, do the typical stoner thing, like, let's get high and, like, go get food and then watch a TV show or movie or something. I would straight up literally, like, go hike, like, miles and miles into the woods, just because that's what felt right to do. And actually, you know, we're talking about good physical lifestyles. I was really fat as a teenager because I played football, and a lot of, you know, the lack of workout, but the, you know, heavy eating habits followed me. So I got really big, like 260 or something. Well, like that.
Real talk, a lot of high school, you know, football coaches and whatnot subtly encourage their kids to get really fucked up like that. Well, it plays better to have like kids tackle some other.
Yeah, people. I was naturally like that, though. I mean, when I was 12 years old, I was like 5'8" and like 180 pounds. I was kind of a weird kid. But anyway, so I was the kind of person that, you know, my friends were like, oh, let's go smoke a blunt and eat Cheetos. And I'm like, how about we do that and go on a nature hike? And then, you know, it's like every eye in the room is on me looking at me like I'm an idiot. Like, why would you even suggest that, you hippie retard? So, I mean, it's funny, even when you talk about using substances like this, you know, people like there's a distinction between the social and the pleasurable. And, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, smoking a blunt and going on a hike is necessarily a ritual or spiritual thing, but it's a hell of a lot more like respectable, in my opinion, or, you know, true, in my opinion, than just like doing it, like you said, as a party favor.
Yeah. And also talking about psilocybin mushrooms, man, go look at the research when it comes to what they have done for people with brain damage. You know, we're talking mushrooms in general are so immensely important, some of them are miraculous. I make tea blends out of mushrooms, out of reishi mushrooms. The reishi mushroom, the Egyptians called it the elixir of immortality. You know what I mean? So it's like these mushrooms have so many wonderful benefits. Psilocybin mushrooms literally fix neural pathways in your brain. They go look it up. It's really incredible what these mushrooms do for you.
And you know, I'll actually plug that for a moment because I know Dave's too embarrassed to do so. We will be, in fact, selling them from the bog, Dave's mushroom mixes. Yeah. And I also want to get them on camera. He needs to send some to me so I can try it out.
All right, I will. Actually, yeah, that's the plan. I'm going to be selling mushroom tea blends here through the bog. So folks are going to be able to get that. The first one is called Un Tea, and it's my own homemade blend. It's got locally foraged reishi mushrooms from here in Pennsylvania. It has hibiscus. It has meadow sweet. It has spearmint. It has turmeric. It has so many things, and it's so wonderful for people that are maybe struggling with anxiety. Now, keep in mind, it is a medicinal thing. It's not like a English tea where you just drink a bunch of it.
These aren't magic mushrooms either. They're not going to like screw you up and get you all high and everything.
Completely. I wouldn't be advertising, you know, magic mushrooms on the bulk.
you could almost say it's almost like a cannabid tea, right? Like some people drink for their anxiety or nausea and other stuff.
Yeah, except it has so many other benefits to it. It has.
I would say it's somewhat closer to like drinking chamomile or lavender or something.
But like I just meant that it's not something you can chug like for a morning beverage. It's like it's a very like one, not one time use, but you know, you don't want to drink it for your standard beverage.
No, it's something that's good. It gives you a little bit of a chill. It's very good for people who have high blood pressure. But because it is, you know, it's mainly used for high blood pressure. If you drink too much, it can lower your blood pressure so bad that it can cause problems. So like one or two cups, and it's perfectly fine. It's good for that. It's got hibiscus and it's got all kinds of stuff in it. We modeled the ingredients after ingredients that were found in an urn that had mead in it from a burial mound dig in Denmark. So this stuff, these reishi mushrooms, man, they're good for your digestion. They're good for your blood pressure. They can actually, they level out your testosterone, or they level out, I believe it's, I forget what it's called, something anti-androgen. It gets rid of hormone blockers, which we have so much of in our stuff, plastics and soy and like all this stuff that screws our hormones up. This will equal it out. So if you're a man, it'll fix your test. And if you're a woman, it'll fix your estrogen. So it's really, really good for many, many things. But most of all, people take it for anxiety and sleep. It's really good for depression. It's good for so many different things. There's a reason the Egyptians called it the elixir of immortality. This is wonderful stuff. And I just love mushrooms in general. One of my kinsmen in my kindred, he is crazy about mushrooms. He knows all the scientific names. He goes foraging all the time and stuff like that. Man, put mushrooms in your life.
They're really good food. They're a superfood. I mean, we know that because we have culinary backgrounds, but you can put mushrooms in almost any food. They'll soak up the flavors of whatever you're cooking with, and they're good for you.
You know what? Real talk, I absolutely hate mushrooms, guys. Like, it, just eating it, I despise the stuff.
We will change that, my friend.
You're going to lion's head mushrooms, or I mean lion's mane mushrooms. Lion's mane mushroom, you can grow them at home. They're very expensive to buy, but you can grow them at home. They are, like, so good for your brain. They are. They literally repair, broken. If you have brain damage, they do so much stuff for your brain to fix your brain. And they have the texture of lobster. They're absolutely wonderfully delicious. They're just really expensive, and I suggest people grow them on their own. But get mushrooms in your life. And on top of that, the psilocybin mushrooms, a lot of people don't even take full dose. They microdose. I know people out there are into Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets, I know he's kind of a hippy-dippy guy and stuff like that. His research into psilocybin mushrooms is absolutely brilliant. The man is brilliant. And it's just people out there that have migraines and cluster headaches, psilocybin mushrooms are the only known treatment for that. There's so much stuff that goes into it, but spiritually, it is a wonderful spiritual tool. Now, I don't know if I'm legally allowed to be on here telling people. So, if you decide to use psilocybin mushrooms, do it responsibly and be there with somebody that's watching over you and take all the precaution and understand that, like I said, it's not a party favor. This is a spiritual tool.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So Yeah, we are over an hour. I went into the mushroom stuff. I love mushrooms.
Yeah, we got Joe Rogan there. We became the Joe Rogan bugs.
Yeah. Everybody, have you ever done DMT? Jamie, pull that up.
Yeah.
Andre, pull that up. You're Jamie.
I actually have done DMT, and I have also several times done LSD. Actually, the reason that I kind of came back to my faith is I had a pretty crazy experience on LSD.
You know what? I actually lied when I said I never did drugs earlier. I did actually do a cannabis edible a couple months back for the first time, and I had a really unfortunate experience that was psychedelic and psychotic delusions. I'll talk about it in some further Bog episode, but it was definitely a thing.
Next time on the Bog, Tristan live streams it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not real keen to repeat the incident, but we'll talk about it sometime.
Yeah. Next time on Dragon Bog Z. Yeah, so we will get into all that and stuff. We could do a whole another episode. We did an episode with Kerwin talking about psychedelics, so if you guys want to go back and check that out. But anyway, we are over time. We got to shut it down for this evening. Anybody have anything in closing?
No, it was a good show.
No, awesome. I pretty much got it. You know, I still have half my stuff, so we might be do another episode like this some other time.
Yeah, we'll do a part two. We'll do a part two. So we're going to shut it down for this evening. Thank you, Tristan. Thank you, Wolfman. Thank you, Andre. Excellent. I got the best co-host in the game, man. Best co-host. But thank you, everybody, each and every one of you, for tuning in. Thank you so much. Many blessings to each and every one of you. Make sure to go to facebook.com/IronAgeJyotish to check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys, this is so, so cool. I get a lot of messages from folks that are out there. Oh, yeah, Mr. Tristan, can you drop in the chat the link to the Spreadshirt for our stuff there? And then, Iron Age Jyotish. Man, I get so many messages, people that went over to Iron Age Jyotish and got their readings done, and it's incredible. The guy's blowing up. He's got a whole big Facebook group with people talking about it, getting into the Jyotish stuff, and it blew my mind. So make sure to go over to facebook.com/IronAgeJyotish and get a reading for yourself if you want to get into some authentic Vedic astrology, man. It's so cool. Make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. And then Tristan just dropped in the chat there, patreon.com/TheBog. If you like The Bog, you want to support us, you want to keep us going, help us keep the lights on, then make sure to go over to patreon.com/TheBog and go sign up. We have tiers from $5 going all the way up to $50, all kinds of different benefits, everything from merchandise, t-shirts, stickers, all kinds of stuff. You get to do. You get to join an exclusive chat to talk with us in person, all kinds of other stuff, as well as an RSS feed so you can get audio for every single episode that we do. I'm a little bit behind because of everything, but I'll get caught up very, very soon for everybody. RSS feed for everybody so you could listen to our audio on your little podcast app or whatever you're using, so you can listen at work, in the car for your commutes, or at the gym, all kinds of stuff. And then make sure we go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, I believe it is, and go pick up some stuff. Man, we got some really awesome merchandise. I did some research and tried to find the place that has the best merchandise. We got a lot of folks coming up with pictures, sending me their stuff, their Bog shirts, their sweatshirts, their hoodies, their aprons, their hats, all kinds of stuff that they're getting from the Bog shop, and it is good, good stuff. So make sure to go over there and get yourself some Bog merch, man. We got insulated bottles for when you're at the gym. We got artisan chef aprons. We got bucket hats. We got maternity shirts. We got dresses. We got anything you can think of that'd be merchandise. We got it over there. Phone cases, pillows, yeah, book bags, all kinds of stuff. Duffel bags, whatever you can think of, it's over there. We got little mason mug cups for people, so you could get your ice and you get your sparkling water in there, whatever you're drinking, your white birch beer if you're up here in PA like me. But anyway, like always, we got to shut it down. I don't have my camera on, so we're going to do it. I got my beer here, and I got my horn out, and we're going to give a hail to our most exalted patrons, the ones that support the Bog, and much love to all of our patrons, but these guys, we give a special thanks because of their support for us. And that's going to be, I'm going to send
them. We're going to play favorites. We love them the most.
We love them the most. They are our most beloved Bog Lords. So to our most beloved Bog Lords, to House Allen, the Allens, to Mr. Corey, and also now to our very own Andre and family. Many hails to you. Hail.
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 Ah, man. Very, very blessed we are. So, all right, we're going to shut it down for this evening. Much love, many blessings to every single one of you guys. I will see you guys next week, next Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on DLive.tv/DaveMartell. Hail.